On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We still can't get over the weather. Flip-flops and cutoffs in January. Winter golf in Chicago. Temperatures 10 and 15 degrees above previous record highs, 30 and 40 degrees above usual. In Colorado, they're using artillery to manage the avalanche threat after huge blizzards. In Washington, the cherry blossoms are sneaking out. In Minnesota, they're water skiing on the Mississippi and canceling ice fishing. Federal meteorologists say no cause for alarm. It's a weather pattern, not a high-speed climate change. But right behind the warm front is a rising fear of global warming. Now, Democrats run Congress. Will they act? Up next on Point, freaky weather, fear of global warming, and the Democrats' playbook on climate change. Later in this hour, three Democratic congressmen will tell us how they plan to take on global warming now that their party has a majority on Capitol Hill. But first, we turn to two experts and their take on the strange winter weather. Joining us from Denver, where more snow is forecast this week, is Robert Henson. He's a science writer at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. He's also a meteorologist and author of The Rough Guide to Climate Change. Robert Henson, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
Also with us from New York City, where Central Park saw temperatures of 72 degrees last weekend, is Gavin Schmidt, a climate scientist with NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. Gavin Schmidt, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you both. And we want to get sorted out, first of all, meteorology and climate, weather and climate and what's going on. Robert Henson, we've heard you talk about this. You're very clear on it. But give it to us one more time in weatherman's terms. What is happening with these great high temperatures in winter alongside those great big snows out where you are? What's going on?
Well, it has been pretty wacky. The funny thing is the pattern has been remarkably spring-like across the country, and that actually includes Colorado. You know, we get our biggest snows in the Denver area in the fall and in the spring, believe it or not, because we have more moisture to deal with.
So this is upside down for Colorado, too, even though it looks like winter with all that snow.
It does look like midwinter, but locals will tell you this feels a lot more like October or March because our high altitude ensures that we're cold enough to get snow in those times of year. And the storms we've had so far have not been all that cold. You know, we haven't been below zero Fahrenheit.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the snows have been very wet snows. And so it's been an incredible amount for midwinter for this part of the country.
So what are the meteorological mechanics driving this crazy weather, Robert?
Well, the jet stream is way far north for this time of year. It's basically been in central Canada a lot of the time, extending over to far northern Europe. And when a storm system has dug into the western southwest United States, it's gotten cut off from the jet stream and basically becalmed and sat there for a couple of days. And that's allowed us to get huge amounts of snow. And at the same time that the northeast U.S. and east coast have been incredibly warm. And that warmth has extended into Europe. Moscow later this week is supposed to be in the 40s with rain, which is almost unheard of for January there.
What has driven the jet stream so far north?
Well, that's been a confluence of factors. You have El Nino in the Pacific, which is an extension of warm water across the entire equatorial Pacific, and that tends to warm the whole globe by a few tenths of a degree. And more directly in the United States, it tends to cause warming in the upper Midwest nearby areas, the northern tier of states. So that's very consistent with what we've seen this winter, you know, Chicago having very little snow all the way up to northern Minnesota. The East Coast is probably more related to the North Atlantic Oscillation, which is a pressure sort of seesaw that takes place between the area around the Azores and around Iceland. That tends to be funneling the jet stream when it's in the positive mode, which it's been in a lot of this winter. It tends to allow for Pacific air to kind of move all the way across the continent off into the Atlantic and all the way over to Europe. So you get a tendency toward warmth on the East Coast and in Europe. So those two things have combined. You also have the baseline of a warmer climate overall that you're laying these factors on top of.
Gavin Schmidt, you're our climate scientist here. How do you look at it? You've experienced this crazy weather in New York. Do you get out of bed in the morning, walk outside in your, you know, boxer shorts feeling just balmy and think global warming has arrived, or does it just look like weather to you?
I agree with pretty much everything that Robert said there. You have these underlying kind of pressures, if you like, and that includes global warming. It includes the ENSO event that's happening now in the Pacific.
Is that El Nino when you say ENSO?
Right, yeah, mm-hmm. ENSO is the technical term which kind of combines that. But yeah, the El Nino event. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got these things going on, and then you've got the normal variations of the weather, the wiggles of the jet stream, storm systems coming through, fronts coming through, which happen every year. But when you've got these small pushes that are always going to that right now are both pushing in the positive direction, then you're going to get some of these record warmths, as opposed to just like one warm week during the winter.
But as a climatologist, do you see it as wiggles then? I mean, what do you say to people living in this who think it may feel great, it's a lot cheaper than a Florida vacation to just walk outside, but it seems so strange. And it's not just records of a couple decades being broken. We've got records of a century being broken.
This last month, the temperatures are all across the U.S. are up to 10, 12, 14 degrees warmer than they are on average. And as you said, records are being broken across the northern part of the U.S.
Are you so sure that's a wiggle?
Well, you have to be very careful, because the trend from global warming is on the order of 0.2 degrees every decade. Now, that sounds like a really small number, but in the global mean, it's actually quite significant. But when you're talking about changes or differences from the average of 10 or 12 degrees, that's an order of magnitude bigger than anything you could directly pin to global warming.
And yet the underlying pressure is there, you say. Let's hear from some of the people living this. Marlene is calling us from Ashford, Connecticut. Hi, Marlene, you're on the air.
Hi, nice to be on the program.
Great to have
you. I just wanted to comment that I work in Alaska during the summer with the University of Washington, and I know that a whole native villages have had to move because of the permafrost melting.
We've seen the pictures. The houses kind of tipping into the sea.
Right.
Exactly. And I also worked on the RV Connecticut Research Vessel for UConn and spoke to Woods Hole scientists who were telling me about the icebergs disappearing. I mean, 95% of the scientific community supports that global warming is happening, but 50% of the articles you read in the media, disparage it, and that is an intentional, policy by people like ExxonMobil and others. And
so when you see this crazy weather, Marlene, does it look like of a piece with global warming to you, or do you listen to our meteorologist here who says this is weather and think that it's that and not so much more necessarily?
Well, I also know that the patterns we're seeing now are, we're getting more Niños, El Niños closer together, and that the weather is intensifying. I noticed some coming back to New England after many years out west that it's warm here until December, and now we're like it's 60 here, and it's crazy. It's like California weather. But when we do get cold, it's very intense. We'll get an intense period in January and February where it was minus 30 with wind chill a couple years ago, which you never saw. I grew up here, so...
Looks new to you, Marlene. Thanks for calling. Robert Henson, are you feeling a new kind of skeptical ear from the citizenry? You hand down the weather report, explain what's happened, and people still say, this is too crazy. They fear something bigger is going on.
There are intuitive things that people pick up on, and one of them, as Marlene alluded to, is the ability to get a cold, sharp cold snap in the middle of what seems like a really warm winter. Chicago had the earliest snowfall they've ever had this year, and they've had hardly any snow since. There were actually snowflakes observed in Savannah and all the way down to Orlando earlier in the fall. So you can, in fact, have an overall warming winter and one that's real consistently warm for periods of, say, a month or so, as we've just seen, and then have sharp intrusions of cold air that seem to enhance this perception of extremes building. Now, it's hard, climatologists, as Gavin was alluding to, have to look at the bigger picture, and when you average it all out, it looks like a small increase in terms of global change, global temperature rise associated with human activities. But those translate and sometimes can translate into larger differences, and the Arctic is a perfect example.
Right, absolutely.
The sea ice in the Arctic is at least as of the end of November was the least extent ever observed. It was setting a new record, and they've set records over the last several years, and it's hard to to pin down how that's happening in terms of affecting northern hemisphere temperatures, but I wouldn't be surprised if there were some sort of interplay going on there.
Gavin Schmidt, do you see a widening public apprehension coming into how people feel, see, understand the weather?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very difficult thing for the climatologist because we're looking at the statistics and we're looking at things that have been happening over decades. And as your caller alluded to, 95% of the people who are working on this are convinced that global warming is a real thing. It is caused by human emissions of things like greenhouse gases and carbon dioxide. And so people are hearing that at a kind of intellectual level. But then they don't really, it doesn't get absorbed until something like this warm winter comes along, and then they associate these two concepts, and then they say, oh, okay, so that's what I've been talking about all this time. And it's not really what we've been talking about, but these things do, like Hurricane Katrina, so that wasn't directly connected to global warming, but more people were probably convinced by Hurricane Katrina that global warming was a real thing than have been convinced by anything that I've ever said on the radio or on TV.
We're going to hear from some Democrats now in the majority in Congress, but if this weather pushed policy, would you welcome that, Gavin Schmidt, if it pushed policy change toward addressing global warming, climate change?
The scientists have been advising policymakers for about a decade and a half now that they need to look at this problem in a serious way. Getting politicians to do anything is not a particularly rational endeavor, and so you look for anything to help push that along.
Gavin Schmidt, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Robert Henson, thanks for being with us.
Good to be here.
We're going to turn to some Democrats in the new majority on Capitol Hill with the new 110th Congress just kicking in. Joining us first today from Washington, D.C., Congressman Earl Blumenauer. He's a seven-term Democratic congressman representing the 3rd District of Oregon, which includes Portland. Congressman Blumenauer, thanks very much for being with us.
Good day, Tom.
The weather has turned everybody's head in the last couple of weeks, and more now. You're sitting there in Washington with the gavels, with the majority. What do you think we can practically expect to see out of Congress now that we didn't in the last dozen years of Republican majority? Anything?
Well, first of all, you have a majority that has been elected that has not been, with its head in the sand, denying the strong probability of global warming. We've had a great group of new people who have been elected. I had a chance to be with in a dozen different states with people around the country. They have different positions as far as the political spectrum is concerned, but I'll tell you, they are united in their concern for global warming, for energy conservation, and I think you're going to see the floodgates open here in Congress, being able to take some aggressive steps to have Congress finally catch up to where the rest of the country is.
We're going to look at what that might entail, but what are you hearing from your constituents? Now, I can't say that I actually know what the Oregon weather was over the last weekend, but what are you hearing from home? And there you sit in Washington where the cherry blossoms have peaked out. How do you feel constituent pressure for yourself and your fellow congressman?
For years, people have been aware of the extreme variability in the weather. And this is something we're watching, for example, in the Pacific Northwest. People have watched the climate change, you know, getting it down real personal in terms of what grapes you grow. For example, Pinot is being grown further and further north. We're looking at situations where snowpacks are highly variable that we rely on for our water. The public is there. That's why my hometown of Portland, Oregon, has been on top of issues dealing with climate change and global warming, has made a commitment, and in fact, we are basically down to 1990 levels of emissions.
In Portland?
In Portland. We're one of 227 cities across the country that has signed on to a compact to deal meaningfully with climate change while we waited for the Republican leadership to get its head out of the sand. I think Congress will be ready to move forward with things from vehicle fuel efficiency standards to portfolio standards.
Portfolio standards meaning?
In terms of
an automaker's overall fleet
emissions? Where energy comes from. I think it's very realistic that we can establish a portfolio standard like George Bush's state of Texas did years ago for alternative energy requirements. You were talking to people in Colorado. That was adopted by a statewide initiative. These are things that the federal government can start moving on immediately. One of the things I hope that Congress is going to be able to do is to stop the interference from the Bush administration to stop state initiatives. For example, California, Oregon, and Washington have made commitments to more fuel-efficient vehicles. It's outrageous that the federal government would try and intervene and prevent that. We ought to be encouraging it and do it with our own fleets.
Let's go to Bill in Ripton, Vermont. Bill, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. It's Bill McKibben calling. And what I'm
Bill McKibben, big-time environmental writer. Welcome, Bill. Nice to have you.
I want to say two things. One is, you know, I wrote the first book on this stuff back in 1989, The End of Nature, and it's only now that I finally feel like there's some political momentum starting to build around that.
Is it going to melt away as soon as the snow comes back, Bill?
No, sir. I mean, I think I can prove that there's political motivation. We launched a website over the weekend called StepItUp07.org. We're trying to coordinate, we're just amateurs, but we're trying to coordinate the first national rally around global warming. There's going to be hundreds of rallies.
Where and when, Bill?
They're going to be everywhere you can think of. We're going to have hundreds of them around the country on April 14th, linked together electronically via the web. And what we're going to try to show, instead of having a march on Washington, what we're going to try to show our congresspeople is exactly what's happening. They're going to be people on the levees in the Ninth Ward. We've got divers who are going to do underwater rallies on the coral reefs off Key West, people on top of Mount Hood and the Grand Teton, all of them saying, cut carbon 80% by 2050. What we need out of Congress is not, I mean, having wasted 20 years, they can't take teensy tiny nibbles now. They've got to step up to the plate. And this is the legislation that Henry Waxman and Jim Jeffords introduced in the last Congress, and we need it sooner rather than later. But here's the news. I mean, we set up this website over the weekend, StepItUp07.org. Within 3 days, we've had people sign up so far to arrange 86 rallies in 29 states. They're coming in at the rate of about a half dozen an hour.
And coming in their cutoff shorts. Bill McKibben, stand by for a moment. Congressman Blumenauer, here's a very well-informed guy who's worked and written on environment with incredible insight for a long time. He wants 80% carbon dioxide emissions reductions by 2050. Is that something you, is that something your fellow Democrats are prepared to sign up for?
I've already co-sponsored Mr. Waxman's legislation. This is something that is within our capacity. I think, as I mentioned a moment ago, I think the public is there. Local governments are doing it across the country. I'm seeing it in my community. Now that we have an opportunity to actually not have the hand sort of preventing our being able to have realistic hearings, we have people in charge of the committees that aren't global warming deniers, Mr. Emhoff, for example. I think
Barbara Boxer taking over from him there in the Senate. Yeah,
I have every optimism that we will be able to follow through with this. It's something I'm committed to doing personally. I've been working on for years and have been frustrated, but I will tell you that you can't go around the country to college campuses, to churches, to deal with people in local government without finding that the support is there. And I appreciate what Bill is doing. I would like to see the moral equivalent of what we had with the Earth Day celebration starting in 1970 with a special focus on global warming, dealing with greenhouse gases. I think the time is right.
Bill McKibben, you're right in the middle of this environmental movement. What's your level of confidence that the Democrats, with the majority in the House, the very slim majority in the Senate, and President Bush in the White House, that they can, that they will make the kind of scale of change that you and other environmentalists are hoping for?
Well, let's stipulate out President Bush for the moment and just worry about what we can get through Congress anyway. Look, it's not going to be easy, even with the Democrats there. ExxonMobil made more money than any company in the history of companies made last year. The only way that we can really counterbalance that power is if we do just what Congressman Blumenauer suggests, have something that is as committed and as passionate as the civil rights movement was. Now, I organized last summer the largest demonstration that's yet taken place in this country on climate change. We had 1,000 people who walked 50 miles across Vermont. That was really good. It was enough to convince even our conservative Republican candidates for Congress and Senate to sign on to that 80% figure. But looked at in another way, 1,000 people as the largest rally is pretty pathetic. We're going to top that if people will go to that stepitup07.org website. We're going to top that by orders of magnitude in April and do our part toward trying to make difference. There's going to be people on church steps and city hall parks and in suburban suburbs across America, each holding rallies and each sending the same message: no more fooling around. Let's do something serious, and let's do it sooner rather than later.
Congressman Earl Blumenauer, are you in position to not fool around anymore?
I mean, well, absolutely. I mean, first of all, Bill and I were at a little session in Middlebury, I believe, in the fall with candidate and now Congressman Peter Welch, where there was where we were talking about global warming and climate change. I mean, it's there. I'm also finding that now that there are some of our Republican friends who are willing to step forward, both from pressure at home and the fact that the you don't have the Tom DeLay sort of group in charge that actually will empower some of them. What we're seeing from the religious community, that including some of the more fundamentalist groups coming forward, I think there's a coalition. I think there's a grand bargain to be made. I'm extraordinarily optimistic and looking forward to rolling up our sleeves and getting some of these specific things done.
Seven-term Democratic Congressman Earl Blumenauer from Portland, Oregon, now in the majority in the House. Congressman Blumenauer, thanks so much for being with us this hour.
My pleasure.
And Bill McKibben, author of The End of Nature, calling in there from Ripton, Vermont. Bill, good luck to you. Thanks for your call today.
Thanks, Tom. Enjoy the winter.
Yeah, well, such as it is. Let me get another congressman here from Washington. We're joined by Tom Udall, Democratic congressman representing New Mexico's 3rd District, serving his 5th term in the House. He's on the Appropriations Committee and the Interior Subcommittee, author of bipartisan legislation on global warming introduced last year. Congressman Tom Udall, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. A real pleasure. And I think the point that was made that this needs to be people-driven. We need to have the American people at every step of the way pushing the Congress to do the right thing. There are many of us, like Earl and myself, that are in the Congress that care about this issue. We've formulated proposals. I couldn't agree more. We need to do it sooner rather than later. Urgency should really be the watchword of the day. Let's get something done. We can work at it along the way. We don't need the perfect bill now. We need to get a start. We need to cap our carbon dioxide emissions. We need to put a price on carbon. My bill would put $7 a ton on carbon dioxide emissions. I think if we put that price on, that's monumental. It changes the whole equation. It sends a strong signal to business, and I think it would unleash the creativity in our business sector to try to meet these goals and to reduce emissions and to move down dramatically.
Lots of concern about the economy as this gets addressed. Would you explain that for us, Tom Udall? A price of $7 a ton on carbon dioxide emissions, what does that mean exactly? How would that work, and what's the huge change you're saying that would affect?
Well, how it works, as all of us know today, with carbon dioxide emissions, there's no price to be paid.
Just pump it out, and that's it, kind of a free removal.
Yeah, if you're a coal-fired power plant, which pumps some of the most of carbon dioxide emissions into the environment, there isn't any cost to be paid. You drive your car down the road, you're emitting for a pound of this every mile.
So you're saying on every exhaust pipe in the country, be it on a factory or a car, there'd be a ticker measuring?
No, because then what we do in our bill is we go way upstream.
Okay.
So you take oil, gas, coal at the point of that they enter the marketplace,
yep,
way upstream, and then for you charge them at that point in terms of emissions, and what they're doing in the economy, $7 a ton. By doing that, it will flow down through the economy, but it sends the strongest signal possible. We don't want to go the tailpipe route like you're talking about. Mm-hmm. That's not going to work. We want to do it there at the very top. Then what you do is you have a, what I would call a safety valve. That's what it's called in our legislation. You allow with a bunch of the best scientists and economists to push that number of $7 up as dramatically as we can to not hurt the economy, but at the same time to meet our objectives. It's really finding that balance and moving up from $7 to $8 and to $9 and do it in such a way that you're sending a strong signal. Mm. You're not bankrupting companies, but you are also spurring the creativity of American business to get producing these technologies that are going to reduce carbon dioxide emissions.
Dan's calling from Bedford, Massachusetts. Hi, Dan, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much. I love your show.
Thank you.
The point I'd like to make is I'm not 100% convinced that global warming is real,
okay.
Although I tend to think it is. But it seems to me, whether it's real or not, the steps we should take are prudent steps, which is burn less oil, and our great-grandchildren will thank us for that.
So will you support politicians who move to do that, even with your uncertainty about it, Dan?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because the oil supply is not infinite. And it may last 10 years, or it may last 100 years, or it may last 500 years.
So all kinds of reasons, and let's go. We hear it. Tom Udall, you're no babe in the woods here. Your dad, Stuart Udall, was Secretary of Interior. Your uncle, Mo Udall, in Congress for a long time, ran for president. You know how politics are. Democrats don't have an insurmountable majority here, and George Bush is in the White House. Do you see the political landscape there? Do you see Republicans ready to join in that could really change American policy in these next 2 years?
I introduced my bill with a Republican aboard in the last Congress, and I believe I'm going to have more Republicans in this Congress. I drafted the bill in the way that answered President Bush's challenges to these kinds of bills, the job-killing argument, the argument that the other countries around the world weren't moving forward. We put provisions in there to deal with that. So I really think if we put our minds to it in the Congress, we realize what a significant issue this is, we reach out to Republicans on the other side of the aisle, we can move forward in a dramatic way. But we need the people behind us. These call people and others that have been on this show mm-hmm. have talked about this being people motivated. We've got to have the people pushing us.
Do you feel the sort of political center of gravity over the hump on this? Or might you still be whacked down? Are you worried about 08, a Democratic presidential challenger, you know, losing ground because people are, say, afraid of hurting the economy by addressing climate change?
I think this is going to be front and center in the presidential race, and I don't think you're going to have many presidential candidates that don't acknowledge, number one, that it's a very serious problem. There may be some disagreement on how to approach it and what to do, but I think you're going to see plans from most presidential candidates saying, we are going to do something about this.
Congressman Tom Udall, thanks very much for being with us.
Absolutely.
We've got more voices from Capitol Hill to join us, but first I want to turn to Juliet Eilprin with the Washington Post. She's covered the environment there a long time and pays a lot of attention to Congress as well. She's author of Fight Club Politics, How Partisanship is Poisoning the House of Representatives. Juliet, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
So what's really on the agenda here? We've heard a couple of congressmen talk about what they'd like to see passed. What do you see front and center with the Democratic majority when it comes to climate change? What are you expecting?
What's on the agenda is hearings. So that's certainly what we're going to see coming out of a few key committees, including the Energy and Commerce Committee and the on the House side and the Government Reform Committee on the House side and on the Senate Environment and Public Works. You'll be seeing a number of hearings where, for example, Democrats are going to be bringing in some respected climate scientists to talk about the extent to which global warming is transforming the planet and how much time we may have left before some of the effects of climate change will be irreversible. And so essentially they're going to be laying the groundwork. Whether bills actually move through both chambers and get signed into law by President Bush, that's a separate question.
Of course, yeah, getting all the way to signed is one thing. Getting through is something interesting in itself. I mean, you've written about, you know, butterflies moving, abandoning southern Europe and flying north where it's gotten more nicer temp for them. Ski lift operators trying to lease federal land higher up the slopes in the Rockies, trying to outclimb the receding snow line. The polar bears, of course, with their trouble on Hudson Bay. Do you feel on the Republican side of the aisle, with all this going on, the public's attention turned by this weird winter weather, do you see congressional majorities? Can you see these things getting through the House, getting through the Senate, never mind President Bush for a moment?
That's a good question. It's conceivable, depending on what bill you're talking about. And again, for example, Congressman Tom Udall has a more pragmatic and more centrist proposal than some of the more aggressive proposals that are out there. And so, you know, you could argue that there might be a chance for that one to go through quicker, although it may not satisfy some of the environmental groups who are very important in this debate. I think you could conceive of congressional majorities, but it's important to keep in mind that, first of all, it still could be tough to get that in the House, which traditionally has been resistant. And in the Senate, you might be able to get a majority of senators supporting something, but given the fact that a minority of senators can filibuster and block legislation from passing, one of the questions is, can you get the 60 votes that you would need to pass an aggressive regulation of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases?
Joe Lieberman saying that he's encouraged but wouldn't say he's optimistic. And Juliet, help us with this. You say Tom Udall's package is a kind of more pragmatic package. I guess that's a kind of code for it treads very carefully on the economic impact.
Absolutely. You know, when he talked about the safety valve that he's included in it, that's something that is something he put in there to reassure industry that he's not going to kill off the jobs the way that President Bush has warned.
I mean, if it cuts too deep, if the expense becomes too high, what, it's sort of a circuit breaker on the whole program or parts
of it? Exactly. You essentially allow companies to essentially, you know, escape from having to comply with the strict reductions.
We're going to hear from another congressman in just a moment, but let me ask you then, Juliet. You know what the environmental groups say is necessary to address climate change, and you've got a pretty good sense of what Democrats are proposing.
Right.
Do they line up, or are the Democrats themselves being pragmatic i.e. not fully at grips with the problem?
Well, there's certainly a lively debate going on within the environmental community, and I think there's certainly some parts of the community that would embrace what Tom Udall is talking about, and there are definitely some that would be resistant to it. And so I think one of the questions is what the congressman was talking about, is the idea of getting something through that could actually be signed into law by President Bush. There are some advocates who say that that's what you really have to do at this point, that the question is so urgent it's important to get something in place within the next 2 years. But there are environmentalists who are talking about holding out until there's either, you know, say a John McCain administration or a Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton administration which is going to be more willing to deal with the issue. And so, in other words, it's worth waiting to cut a better deal 2, 3, 4 years from now.
Juliet Alperin with The Washington Post. Please stand by for a moment. I want to welcome into our conversation Congressman Jay Inslee. He's a six-term Democratic congressman, represents the 1st District in Washington State, includes Puget Sound. He's on the Energy and Commerce Committee and the Natural Resources Committee. Congressman Inslee, thanks very much for being with us.
You bet. Thanks for such an important topic, being on the air.
So what about this question of whether the Democrats or environmentalists across the party lines are now in a position to act on legislation that is up to the scale of the climate challenge here? Do you see that having emerged out of this election or not?
Well, I think this is the most rapidly changing issue in the country since I've been in politics. We have seen this enormous resistance to the clear science of climate change for so many years now, essentially, unfortunately, led by President Bush. And that resistance is cracking. The bad news is that the ice is melting and the glaciers are receding, and we just saw an ice shelf collapse up north. But the resistance to the science of global warming is also collapsing, and that's the good news. So I am actually optimistic that in the next 2 years we can make progress, and we do have to. This is too urgent to put off, and so I'm pleased that we're seeing, I think, a fairly rapid movement in Congress to start talking about real solutions to this problem. I have, as you know, the new Apollo Energy Project that basically says that we need to look at this as an economic opportunity as well as an environmental challenge, because the world is going to need new energy technologies, and we are prepared to deliver them. So we are arguing this is we need to look at this as an opportunity to grow our economy and to grow our technology as well as saving the planet.
And the progress that you anticipate, Congressman Inslee, do you see it as being up to the scale of the challenge, or are we going to be nibbling while, in the view of some environmentalists and others, you know, this thing is bearing down on us like a tsunami?
Well, I think there are things that there are easy, medium, and hard things to get done. The easy things will get done, and those will be done in the next few months, are to have significant increases in our investment in biofuels, which can, if properly done in the next generation of biofuels, reduce our CO2 emissions once we get to a cellulosic ethanol. I think that will happen with substantial bipartisan support. I think you'll see some increased research and development on a whole suite of technologies. And I think you'll hear the president talk about that, even this president, in his State of the Union. I think those things will get done with broad bipartisan support. The next level of issues are things that are somewhat more difficult, which is to reorient the auto industry towards high-mileage vehicles, to flex-fuel plug-in vehicles, to enhance our ability to have choice for biofuels and plug-in vehicles. Mm-hmm. And to do that, we need to do what Brazil has done, which is to basically insist that we have flex-fuel vehicles that will burn either ethanol or gasoline, and that we have to insist that the oil and gas companies put them in. And we also have to take some major measures to advance the electrification of our vehicles. The harder issue, but the most important ultimately, is to have a cap on carbon dioxide, either through the way that Tom Udall talked about, which is a specific charge, or through a cap and trade system, which sets a limit on the total CO2 going into the atmosphere annually, and forcing industries to bid for the right to put those amounts in. The latter is probably a more aggressive way, and probably in the long term something that we'll need. But one way or another, the pivotal thing to drive these new technologies is to impose a cap on CO2. Now, when that happens, I believe that we are going to unleash the floodgates of technological innovation in this country. And I literally, 2 days didn't go by when I don't meet a new a small business person or inventor who has a new technology. We've got thin cell solar technology coming in that could be 30 to 40% cheaper. We've got wave technology coming in where there's enough energy off our coast to power California, ultimately. We've got the electrification of the car, which we're making substantial strides in the battery, that ultimately you can have a car that's driven by our existing electrical grid. Very interesting study came out last week from Pacific Northwest Labs in Washington State that concluded that we have enough electrical generating capacity today to power 85% of our fleet of automobiles without building one single new plant of any dimension. In other words, we have all this unused capacity at night we don't use. We simply can use it and plug in our vehicles ultimately to charge at night. So there's a lot of good news out there about America's ability to innovate our way out of this crisis, and I will believe we will do so once we get the right signals to the investment community and to the market that we can no longer put CO2 into the air for free. It is the biggest loophole in our environmental laws, and we've got to close it. And we can't do it just by incentives either. The president's going to talk about a lot of incentives in his State of the Union speech, I predict. But you can't incentivize such a dramatic reorientation of our economy. It's like saying we could stop bank robbery by just giving incentives to bank robbers not to rob banks, and it just doesn't work that way. We have to impose a cap on CO2 one way or another.
A lot of people who would like to see America get up on top of this challenge, but we've learned not to be naive about that happening. Let me take some calls, if I may, Congressman Juliet Alperin. Jeff's calling from Norfolk, Virginia. Hi, Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I would just like to remind all of the listeners how powerful clear lines of communication with their representatives are. Elected officials know that each time they're contacted by one of their constituents, that represents a given number, say 500 or 1,000, that feel the same way, that are not communicating. And that, you know, as voters, that's great that we vote, but it's just not enough.
So pick up the phone, stay on it. Do you feel a moment coming here, Jeff, where environmental policy may change in this country?
I feel a moment where all policy may change, that environmental included, that if the people stay on top of it and don't and refuse just to be passive, that we can really transform this country in every area.
There's the call, and we appreciate it, Jeff. Let me get another here from St. Louis, Missouri. Bob is on the line. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi. I wonder if all the congressmen will be in favor of extending the 2000 and the tax credits are set to expire 2007 for solar and geothermal, wind, high efficiency furnaces. Will they all be on board for that?
You want to see tax credit extended? And what about the Democrats and Republicans and bipartisanship here? What do you expect, Bob, from this Congress?
Well, from what I hear now, I tell you, I'm afraid that it's just settling back down into politics, because I hear a lot of Republican and Democrat, a lot of bashing the president. And I'm in the energy business, and we've never had a better environment for selling alternative energy at the residential level since probably 1975, as we've got now with the we got a $2,000 tax credit for installing a solar system in a home.
Right.
We get $2,000 to $3,000 tax credit for buying a hybrid car. We get a tax credit for installing a windmill, and we haven't had those. You know, all the years that the Democrats, that Al Gore was in the Senate and as vice president, none of that existed.
So it's looking good to you right now. Bob, let us pick that up. Congressman Inslee, what about it? First, Bob wants to know, will the tax credits likely be pushed forward beyond 07? And what about bipartisanship here? Is this going to be turned into a purely political thing, or can we somehow loft this in spite of or above that?
Well, yes, the tax incentives should and I believe will be extended, but it's very important in my research in this to we need to change how we do tax credits. Traditionally, Congress has done them 1 year at a time, which is an absolute joke when it comes to giving confidence to the venture capital community that these are going to have long-term economic stability. So when we do these tax credits, we have to do them for multi-year periods. And I am very hopeful that we're going to do them for 5 or 10 year periods so that we can give these new startup companies investment stability. When they go to their investors, they know that they're going to have this business plan, and that's very, very important. Bipartisanship is increasing on this issue, just as Americans' awareness is increasing of this issue. I'm working with a group of Republicans and Democrats on the next generation of a biofuels bill to try to inspire the next generation of biofuels. We have sort of the first generation now of corn-based ethanol.
Yeah.
We need to go to an enhanced cellulosic that can be much more productive from a CO2 basis and from an energy basis per acre, probably 2 to 3 times as productive. And I'm working with Republicans to do that. And we'd obviously like to make this as bipartisan as possible. I think that the most difficult schism in that regard, though, is on the most fundamental aspect of this policy, which is to impose a cost on carbon dioxide. And unfortunately, a lot of my Republican colleagues seem that that's somehow a communist plot. Now, we do it for sulfur dioxide. We do it for nitrogen oxide. It's just that we have the loophole for the biggest, most dangerous, earth-threatening chemical on the planet.
And why do you think that is? Because it's oil companies whose profits depend on that, or because they just don't believe it's a problem?
I think it's part of that. I think it's part that some of my Republican colleagues, who are friends of mine, and I work with them on a daily basis, you know, they believe that regulatory action by any government is inherently suspect. But all we're doing is protecting an asset. This is a conservative position. We all own the atmosphere in common, and it's being trespassed upon by now by these industries putting CO2 in the air. And it's a property right that we all hold in common. In a sense, it's a conservative position. So we've got to fix the marketplace, which today says you can put your garbage in my air and my lungs for free. You and I, when we go to the garbage dump, we have to pay $25 to put a pickup load of our garbage into the dump.
Mm.
But it's free to put CO2 in the air.
Juliet Alpern, you watch Congress closely. You wrote Fight Club Politics, and it's a great book. Do you see the partisan gridlock being broken here?
I think there's a possibility for it to be broken in a way there hasn't in the past, but it's definitely still a serious challenge, as I think Congressman Inslee laid out, that it's one thing to provide tax incentives for people to buy solar power for their homes or you know, to fund biofuels research. It's much harder to impose a carbon cap, as you know, the people on the show have laid out. And so I think that they're going to encounter some resistance, both among Republicans on the Hill and, more importantly, from President Bush. He has consistently opposed a mandatory cap. And while it's not out of the question entirely, I think that's where you're going to see some really serious partisan contest between the White House and the Democratic leadership in the House and Senate.
Juliet Alperin, national environmental reporter for The Washington Post, author of Fight Club Politics. Juliet, stay cool or warm. I'm not sure which to wish you, but thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Congressman Jay Inslee, six-term Democratic congressman, represents the 1st District in Washington State, their Puget Sound and around. Congressman Inslee, wonderful to have you. Good luck with the next term. Thanks for being with us today.
You bet.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.